This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Every Friday, we break up the show to pay attention to some of the things that we maybe couldn't spend a whole hour covering. We call it the Friday Pitch-In. But these days, the one thing on everyone's mind is the coronavirus pandemic. However, we know you may be wanting a break from that. So we're going to spend just a little time getting an update on the Indiana side before touching on some lighter topics later in the show. Coming up, we'll hear about a new book focusing on Indiana's early spring wildflowers because we can still enjoy the outdoors. And later, more on what will be the Midwest's largest planetarium, an astronomy and STEM education facility in Westfield, Indiana. But first, catching us up on the statewide news, the triumphant return of our Indiana Public Broadcasting digital producer, Lauren Chapman. Hi, Lauren.
Da-da-da-da.
Welcome back.
It's good to be back.
And what crazy times to return.
You know, Brandon could have taken this for another couple of weeks, and that would have been okay. I missed hanging out with you guys. But it feels a little bit like I'm in the middle of a marathon.
Oh, we missed you too, but we enjoyed having Brandon around. And Brandon will be back this coming, he was back. I've lost track of time. He was back yesterday recapping the session. My goodness. Anyway, what did you hear this morning? What's the latest on the coronavirus pandemic in numbers out of Indiana?
Yeah, so as of yesterday at midnight, the State Department of Health updates these numbers. At midnight every night. So as of yesterday, we have 79 confirmed cases,
wow.
Two deaths, and the great number is 554 people who have been tested. That has grown exponentially. That's a 200 case increase from just yesterday, if my memory is serving correctly. Mm. So that is continuing to grow in no small part, according to State Health Commissioner Chris Box, to a partnership between the state and Eli Lilly, who has agreed to use their laboratories to try and get testing a little bit faster for state health and state and county health departments.
Is anyone making projections on what numbers will look like about this time next week or further into the future?
Yeah, you know, both the GOP chairman and Governor Holcomb were asked questions about projections at this press conference earlier today, and they both kind of stared for a second at the person asking the question. It was just like, have you lived the last 5 days?
Oh.
It's hard to project exactly what's going on right now and to see how it's going to increase. But as Chris Box said, you know, as we get more people who are tested, we are also increasing the number of people who are going to test positive. And she also said for the 79 confirmed cases, that includes people who have been sent home from the hospital, but it also includes a handful of people who do have severe illnesses. So we could see that, and we will eventually see that death number click up a little bit.
Because the way this is going, not everyone who has it has these severe symptoms.
Yeah.
You can just carry it around and have milder symptoms.
Yeah. The symptoms are shortness of breath, cough, and then a low-grade fever. So I have spring allergies, so I've been taking my Allegra every night because – not a plug for that, by the way. But I've been taking my Allegra every night mostly because I don't want anybody to, you know, accidentally get it if I'm a carrier and I'm sneezing. So – take your allergy pills if you have seasonal allergies, you know, social distancing. As Holcomb said today during the press conference, if we do the recommendations from the CDC, if we socially distance, if we do all of those, if we're washing our hands, then we will get out of this faster.
What have we heard on the federal response?
Yeah, so the federal government has three federal stimulus packages that have been proposed by the U.S. Department of the Treasury. Now, the first one was signed by the president earlier this week. I think it was this week. That sent $8.3 billion to federal health organizations, and it creates grants for state and tribunal health organizations, and it also kicks in money to help small businesses. Definitely this last week, he signed a bill that would pay for testing and open access for unemployment, about $8 million to make sure COVID-19 testing is free and covered by insurance companies, and to shore up programs like SNAP, TANF, and WIC.
You mean $8 billion?
$8 billion with a B.
Okay. Gotcha.
So that's the second $8 billion package.
Oh.
And then there's a third package to help individuals and small businesses. Now, this is the one that a lot of folks are talking about because the proposal from Treasury Department's Steven Mnuchin was that basically every adult American, according to the plan as of yesterday afternoon, would get $1,000. And for households with children, each child would count for $500 to kind of make up for the furloughed employees, people who have lost their jobs, and to try and keep the economy chugging along, even as everything is shutting down. Mm-hmm. What we don't know about this, however, is we don't know about authorized workers under visas. We don't know about folks who are here in different ways outside of citizenship. And so there's a lot of questions about how that would happen and the dollar amounts at the end of time, at the end of things. Senator Todd Young had a press conference yesterday that I actually covered, where he talked about, you know, there's a chance that that $1,000, that $2,000 that Democrats are talking about could be, you know, ramped down significantly. But it's true that the White House and the Treasury Department are very interested in getting that money to folks as soon as possible to help them. And additionally, to help small businesses, that's also a huge chunk of money for folks who are running small businesses to pay payroll and to keep their doors open through the end of this.
And of course, there's a lot going on the state level as well.
There's so much going on at the state level.
First of all, the big news this morning was that the May primary is not the May primary anymore.
No, the May primary is getting pushed back to June 2nd. So the voter registration deadline, mail-in deadlines for military spouses, et cetera, are all pushed back, mostly because those deadlines are established by what day the primary happens. So if that gets pushed back, everything else does as well, which is convenient for me because I'm working on a voting guide for how to register to vote and how to get a mail-in ballot. So appropriate. And speaking of mail-in ballots, though, you know, Indiana has one of the most stringent requirements for vote by mail. And today, this is breaking news, the Secretary of State, Connie Lawson, announced with Governor Holcomb that those requirements have been relaxed. Anybody who wants a vote by mail ballot can get one. The caveat being that they're really urging folks who can, who aren't a part of higher risk groups, to go vote in person early, because the mail-in ballots require a different way of counting votes. And so that is very likely to overwhelm county election boards in those offices. So that's going to be a huge deal for them once we get to that June 2nd date.
And we just did a show about an effort to increase Indiana's ability to do vote by mail with a group called Indiana Vote by Mail. If you want to check that out on our podcast feed, in very interesting conversation and recent enough to where we referenced COVID-19 and the pandemic that's sweeping the nation and indeed the state, of course. Mm-hmm. How is the state health department partnering with Lilly?
Yeah, so basically Lilly has opened up their laboratories and is helping get that testing done faster and quicker. There's another organization, Roche Diagnostic, that's working on a test, and I believe the numbers 400,000 tests out per week. That might be by day, but so Roche and Lilly are both their North American headquarters are in Indiana, so they're both making that happen right now.
Mm, excellent. And what about education? Schools are still closed.
Schools are closed until May 1st at the very least. And of course, that is subject to change. We can't really predict how long it'll be. But the likelihood is that schools will be closed at least until May 1st, maybe through the end of school years. Probably. That also then brings up the problem of standardized testing. So the Indiana Department of Education has been working with the Fed to try and figure out how to basically get relief and to essentially hold harmless again schools and districts from those federal requirements. Kids aren't going to be able to do standardized testing when they don't have a standardized classroom either. And that is because folks are doing a lot of e-learning or worksheet packets from home for kids that don't have access to internet and don't have a lot of those other resources.
That was going to be my next question. E-learning has got to be a challenge. I mean, this all happens so fast. And for some schools that clearly may not have had a contingency plan for e-learning, that had to have been a challenge.
I mean, also consider that Indiana has an inherent problem with broadband infrastructure. So even if your school has all of the resources to, you know, even if your school has one-to-one devices for students, it's not necessarily true that their parents have access to that, that their county has access to that, or even their street. So for especially kids who are at most risk are kids who are inner city kids who may or may not have access to internet at home, and kids who are rural, who are kind of out in the middle of the heartland, mm-hmm. Who may not have access to that either because of our broadband infrastructure issues.
Mm. The governor has made some executive orders. What's been going on with those?
So he made an announcement yesterday that is far-reaching, adds flexibility around everything from the Bureau of Motor Vehicles, where you're not going to get penalties for a handful of things, to mental health care access, opening it up to telehealth, and insurance coverage, making sure that folks who are being tested for COVID-19 are not facing the brunt of that cost. And among those other steps, Indiana is delaying state income tax filing and payments until July 15th. Small businesses are now eligible for the federal disaster loans, which I believe is separate from the small business loans of the third federal package, a stimulus package. And Holcomb says the state is basically broadening its unemployment laws and offering a lot of flexibility with how they interpret those laws as well. So yesterday he said 1 year ago this week, 3,100 people had applied for unemployment. And this week, 22,583 had.
Mm. And we are using our Indiana 2022-way texting tool to kind of engage with listeners about COVID-19. How are we doing that?
Yeah, so we are, in a lot of the stories that I'm referencing, we have an embed question. So we are taking those questions. If you leave your email address with us, we will answer you. We will find, if we have not already reported on that topic, we will go and find it. Mm. And that is what is informing a lot of our reporting right now. Additionally, we're still talking about elections. We're still talking about those issues. And a lot of the things that the federal and state response is also falls under election platforms. So we are having this conversation along with the conversation of elections. But we're here. We're doing the thing. So if you text elections to 73224, you can join the Indiana 2022 way. And we're doing everything. We're trying to make sure that we're answering your questions. This is a really scary time for a lot of people. And we want to be able to provide that information for you.
Are you eating a lot of takeout?
Oh, yes.
You're still coming to work. You're one of the few people who are coming into the building, and we appreciate it.
I negotiated my way into that. But yeah, getting a lot of takeout, trying to support local businesses as possible. And that's just kind of the reality we live in right now.
Lauren Chapman is Indiana Public Broadcasting's digital producer, and she joins us every week for our Friday Pitch-In. Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you so much for having me.
Up next, we welcome the author of a children's book that focuses on some of the earliest spring wildflowers that can be seen throughout the state. Former DNR botanist Mike Homoya loves Indiana wildflowers, and you can hear it in his voice. The outdoors isn't closed yet. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back with that in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Just before midnight last night was the official spring equinox, making today the first full day of spring. It's a hopeful time, but given the news, it may not seem like it. However, it's still okay to go outside by yourself or in a small group and enjoy the fresh air and admire what nature has in store in the coming months. My guest is one of the contributors for a title chosen to represent Indiana for the Library of Congress's National Book Festival in Washington, D.C. last fall. The book is Wake Up Woods, and Indiana botanist Mike Homoya is on the line with us now. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Matt.
Mike, I just want to start by saying I'm in Indianapolis, and you're in Brownsburg, which is just northwest of us, and you'd normally be perfectly willing to come downtown and talk in person, but given the circumstances, we're really glad that you are where you are. This book has gotten a good bit of attention since it came out last fall. Were you surprised by that?
Yes, pleasantly so. it is now in its third printing. They've sold out the two previous printings, and it really indeed has exceeded our expectations. People from all over the country are ordering the book. It's being sold even in as faraway places as the New York Botanical Garden. So, indeed, it is quite a treat to see its popularity.
Do the plants mentioned in the book apply there near the New York Botanical Garden?
Yeah, absolutely. you know, this book was written and illustrated and developed by Hoosiers. However, the plants that are in there show no political boundaries, and practically all of them are wide-ranging enough that the entire northeastern quarter of the United States would benefit from a book such as this, because these plants grow in all these different states.
So it's called Wake Up Woods. Let's start generally, and we can get specific later. What's it about?
It is about the earliest flowering spring plants, and that's the Wake Up Woods part. You know, we have plants in the state. There are approximately 2,000 native plants in Indiana. But these that we focused on are wildflowers that are common enough that can be seen at most any site. And they're the earliest blooming one. In fact, some of them are already starting to bloom in Indiana. And the Wake Up Woods part is that we now, as we're getting into warmer temperatures and longer days, these plants that botanists refer to as spring ephemerals, they're coming up early now. They're going to bloom while there's still enough sunlight coming through the forest canopy. No leaves on those trees yet. So these plants are coming up, capturing the light energy while they can. They're blooming now, and then in a period of several weeks or so, they will actually disappear. So but it's not just the plants that are waking up, it's the animals as well. And if you were to take a stroll out in the woods now, you would see a lot of animal activity, from things conspicuous like birds, for instance, but even the tiniest little insects and ants and tiny little bees are all swarming around, pollinating the flowers and collecting the seeds for food and so forth. So it's focusing on these earliest plants.
So the woods literally is waking up. And this isn't the product of just one person. You're not the only author here. There are three people credited on the cover. You for the text, and who else?
Well, the illustrator is Jillian Harris. She's a Bloomington-based. Did some just fabulous illustrations and paintings that, in and of themselves, they're definitely works of art and quite eye-catching and appealing. And then Shane Gibson is the other author. He wrote some short poetry verses that are quite clever and catchy and really get you thinking about what you're looking at.
All right, let's get into it. Among these early blooming plants are violets. How common are violets in Indiana?
Well, there are some species that are very common. In fact, one in particular is very likely growing in your backyard. In fact, some people try to get rid of them in their lawn, but they are a native plant. They do have attractive flowers and do serve a valuable purpose, not only out in the wilds, but in your backyard as well. If you like bees, for instance, honeybees in particular, but native bees as well. But there are several other species in the state, and many of them are very early blooming in the woods. There are probably a dozen or so, at least, species in Indiana, probably more, ranging color from the violet. You know, that's how that color name got its name, was from the flower. And but there are others that are yellow, for instance, and white. And so there are several of those species. And so we have pollinators that are involved. And when they pollinate flowers, they're gathering either nectar or pollen from those flowers and utilizing that as food. But the leaves also support a number of species, including a beautiful group of butterflies called fritillaries, and they are very host specific. Their caterpillars will only feed on violet leaves. So were it not for violets, we wouldn't have these fritillaries. And there are all kinds of hosts and interactions with animals that exist out in nature that is pretty amazing. Many people don't know about them. And that is all discussed in this book, at least with a few species. And it's just a start, really. Like I say, the book is aimed towards children and young adults, young readers. But, you know, it's really value and interest, I think, to adults who've never had any exposure or experience with our native plants, or maybe they've taken a hike in the woods and wondered what that plant was. This book would be beneficial for them as well.
Well, I'm definitely in that group. I look around and I appreciate what I'm seeing, but I don't know what I'm seeing. And I am surprised to hear you say that there are white and yellow violets. Are violets usually violet, though, or has my whole life been a lie?
Most of the species are. Most of them are.
And plants are fascinating to me. You know, you see some of the more extraordinary examples on big nature documentaries like Life and Planet Earth and things like that. But the book says that even the violet has a pretty surprising way of dispersing its seeds, at least surprising to a total novice like me, like I've said. What happens when a violet does that, I guess?
Yeah, well, you know, the idea behind the flower is to produce a fruiting capsule or some other form of fruit. Of course, we're all familiar with fruits, many of different plants that we eat and benefit from. But all flowering plants have fruits of some sort, and the main purpose is reproduction. And within those fruits are seeds. And the fruit of a violet is a capsule. And in that capsule are all these tiny little seeds. And eventually that capsule dries out. And what happens is there's like a trigger there, a mechanism. Once they get so far along in maturation, those capsule walls split and eject the seeds out away from the capsule itself to some distance. Now, we're not talking tens of feet, but at least it's some distance away from the plant to ultimately, the plant hopes, to generate new seedlings of violets and more plants. So it's all about reproduction.
So it's like it's spring-loaded. It pops it out?
Yeah, right.
Wow. All right, let's move on to another plant mentioned in the book, bloodroot, whose flowers only last a day or two. Why such a short window?
Well, that is a question I don't know that anyone absolutely knows, but maybe it gets its job done by then. Of course, again, its purpose is for reproduction, and perhaps pollination and fertilization occurs quickly enough for that plant that it no longer needs to attract additional ones. And once pollen has been transferred, let's say from one flower to the next, and fertilization takes place, then again, those petals may just shed itself because it's saying, okay, insects, you no longer need to visit me because my job is done, and ultimately will be to form seeds for new plants.
And when is that window, I guess? When can we find a flowering bloodroot?
Oh, very soon.
Very soon.
It's definitely one of the earliest of our flowering plants, not the very earliest. The most early is one that we call skunk cabbage, which is an odd name. That's not in this book, and it's not one of the most common plants around the state, but I saw a population in flower in Marion County 3 weeks ago. So it's in the end of February, it was in bloom. Now, it's not a showstopper. It's not a big showy thing, but it's early, but bloodroot is not too far behind it. And I would guess in far southern Indiana that there may be some just about ready to bloom, or maybe at least by this weekend. Here in central Indiana, it might be a couple of weeks yet. It's really hard to predict, but it's not unusual for them to be in bloom by the end of March here in central Indiana. And the leaf wraps around the stem. You don't even see the leaf. All you'll see is a single stem with this attractive little daisy-like flower at the tip. And it's an interesting, attractive little plant.
And how do bloodroot seeds get out into the world?
Well, like a lot of these early blooming plants, these seeds have a part of them that we'll call a food body. Elaiosome is the botanical term for it, but it's actually sort of a bit of plant fat attached to the seed. And of course, that's attractive to some animals, and in particular ants. And they will take these seeds along with that attached food body off to their nest. And of course, you know, ants, a lot of ants are having their nest underground. So they're helping to disperse the range of the bloodroot species, for instance, by taking those seeds. And once they eat that food body, they don't actually eat the seed itself. So the seed is there already buried and ready to germinate and grow into a new plant. And it would be as, you know, as much as several feet away from the parent bloodroot plant.
Now, when I see wildflowers on a spring hike, I often just see various shades of white, maybe some yellow or purple, but the book mentions two varieties that turn these gorgeous shades of red. What are they?
Well, the first one that would be seen is a plant called fire pink. And it's just a brilliant red flower. You can't miss it. It's widely distributed over most of the state, but it's not something you would call abundant. But almost every woods you would go to, for instance, I would almost venture to say every state park, at least, if you were to go, you would come across this plant. And it's called fire pink, and it's well named because it is so fiery red. And they call it pink because it's in a group of plants, a family called the pink family, which includes carnation. So just because it's called a pink family doesn't mean all the plants in that family are pink in color.
Hmm.
That's just a name of some of them, and they just decided to call it the pink, or the carnation family is another name for it. So that's a brilliantly red flower. And in fact, years ago when there was an attempt to try to get our state flower changed from the peony to a native plant, fourth grade school children selected it as their choice to be our state flower, but that didn't go any farther in the legislature, and it just kind of ended there. The other plant that's quite attractive and red is a columbine. Most people are aware of columbines either for some they grow in their garden, there's several really showy ones, as well as out in the western states, there are quite a few native species in the Rockies, for instance. But here in the eastern United States, we have only one, and that's what we just call the wild columbine. And those two are probably the most brilliantly red spring wildflowers that we have.
And I think what's really special about fire pink and wild columbine are the pollinators. Who's visiting these flowers?
A variety of insects, but one animal that is quite appealing and familiar to everyone is our native hummingbird. It's called the ruby-throated hummingbird, and it has an attraction to red flowers in general, not just these two plants. And it'll feed on plants of other colors as well, but red always seems to catch its eye, and the fire pink and the columbine are definitely two that it targets. We only have one species of hummingbird that's here native and nesting in Indiana.
Now, that's all I've got on the book, but I don't often get a chance to talk to a botanist, and I have a lot of questions. We're headed into spring. People are excited. I know I am for spring, but I'm also a homeowner with a lawn. As a person with knowledge of native plants and the importance of a balanced ecosystem, I'm curious how you manage your lawn or your landscaping at your house.
Well, I should say that some people might think I don't do any management, but I do mow it. I do mow it. Don't get me wrong. I try to stay in good graces with my neighbors, but I don't utilize any fertilizers or broadcast herbicides widely in my yard. And, you know, so it's a diverse lawn. And some people might say, well, you've got a lot of weeds in your lawn. And many of them are, you know, some might think are quite noxious weeds, but like dandelions, for instance. But I don't mind dandelions because bees are at least getting some benefit from them. I think my bigger concern is why I don't use those chemical products is that eventually some of that's going to run off. And if you take everyone's yards collectively, with, let's say, just a little bit of runoff from each of them, ultimately that can add up to a lot of runoff of these chemicals and so forth. And so I figure, why do that? It's certainly not a healthy thing. It does have impacts on wildlife and our vegetation, aquatic vegetation, and ultimately us. So I can live with these lawn weeds.
Mike, what are some of your favorite places to visit in Indiana to see wild plants?
Oh, there's so many. I usually say, well, it's the last place that I visited, but
which would be?
That might be Portland Arch Nature Preserve, which is a beautiful canyon over in west central Indiana, somewhat similar to Turkey Run or Shade State Park. Those have some rich floral displays. One of the plants mentioned in the book is bluebells, Virginia bluebells. There is a display growing along the borders of Sugar Creek as it runs through Turkey Run State Park that is just unbelievable. You would think the sky has settled down onto the forest floor. It's just a massive blue, and it's just awesome.
Michael Moya is the text author of the very informative and scientifically accurate children's book, Wake Up Woods. Mike, happy spring.
Thank you very much. You as well.
Up next, Westfield, Indiana is on track to become a hub for STEM education in the state with the announcement of a new facility that will be home to, among other things, the largest planetarium in the Midwest. We'll talk to one of the leaders of the project next. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Westfield, Indiana is planning something big. Their Grand Park Sports Facility is already the home of Colts Training Camp and hosts 2.5 million visitors a year for various games and tournaments. But a new addition just east of Grand Park plans to bring the entire universe down to Earth. Here to talk about it is Director of Science Engagement with the Link Observatory Space Science Institute. He's also co-leader of Westfield's Grand Universe Project. John Shepard, welcome.
Hello.
I'm a big astronomy buff, John, so I'm already hooked here. But tell us what this is going to be. What are we expecting in Westfield?
Well, where do I begin? well, it Grand Universe, the whole thing is about 105,000 square foot facility on 60 some acres. And it'll have the capability of both daytime, nighttime, and then in climate weather observing, really.
So telescopes, so it doesn't have to be clear at night. It doesn't even have to be nighttime in order to use some of these.
No. We'll have solar telescopes. They'll be the largest commercial solar telescopes. We'll have two of them. And then also we'll have two of the largest, public viewing scopes. There'll be plane wave scopes, 24 inches.
What does that mean, plane wave?
Plane wave is a manufacturer.
Oh, okay.
Of telescopes.
Well, like a brand name. Gotcha.
Yeah. And then we will have a radio telescope. So it doesn't make any difference whether it's cloudy, whether it's raining, or anything. We can still look at other things. Well, let's put it this way. We can look at other things, but what we'll be receiving is radio signal. We'll look at the energy coming from black holes or radio galaxies or energetic stars, you know. Things like that.
Are there other radio telescopes in Indiana?
There is one down at Indianapolis University. I think it's there for the students to use. I actually operate two radio telescopes out in the Mojave Desert for NASA.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And will you be able to operate those telescopes from this facility or dial into other facilities from this Westfield Grand Universe?
We will have a NASA control center at the facility, and we can operate scopes around the world.
Wow.
Matter of fact, I use, I think right now, 7 scopes around the world. So I can observe something 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, if my wallet can withstand it.
because telescope time equals
money.
Telescope money.
Yes.
When is Grand Universe opening?
We are hoping on the same time as the Artemis project, which NASA is launching, to put man and woman on the moon at the same time in 2024.
So you're hoping to be open perhaps in time to celebrate, maybe have a big event as we watch the broadcast of someone of us returning to the moon?
We will have a big bash.
Hopefully that'll be the grand opening.
It should be.
So why is this place, Grand Universe, why is it important to have? It's easy for me to ask you that, but what's your answer?
Well, if you look at our current students, we are probably 24th in the nation for STEM education. That's not too good. But if you look at the United States, we are really down on the list as far as leaders in STEM education. We used to be number one when we had the Apollo program. And if you look at the number of PhDs, which is usually what you can track easily with the Apollo program, the Apollo program peaked. And as soon as the Apollo program shut down, the number of PhDs in the pure sciences fell. And so we're looking at being able to get students interested in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, kind of a renaissance of our standing in the nation. We'll have the, well, I guess you would say the Walt Disney productions of, you know, STEM here in Indiana.
You're an educator. You teach at IUPUC down in Columbus. The students that you see and the minds that you help to shape, does that give you hope? Have you seen some promise in the youth of today for STEM?
When I teach, I'm sometimes I'm kind of animated as far as when I get on a real good topic that I really like. You know, when you're a teacher, a lot of times you can look out the class, and if it's something that the kids are not getting, you know, the eyes are glassed over or whatever else. But then you see that one individual in the back of the room, all of a sudden the lights come on, and it makes the whole day worthwhile.
Now, let's talk about your kind of track to where you are now. You've always been, you've always had a career in science. 40 years with Lilly.
That's right.
As they don't have much call for an astrophysicist. What were you doing for Lilly?
I was a molecular and cellular biologist.
And so after a 40-year career at Lilly, you went and got a PhD in astrophysics?
I started my PhD. I didn't finish my PhD.
Oh, you didn't? Okay. But
it's Albert dissertation.
10-4, which is the hardest part.
Yeah.
Of course.
I found I liked the gathering and finding the data rather than describing the data.
Understood. I guess has the last 12 years since you've been teaching at IUPUC felt more like a retirement since you worked for 40 years at Lilly?
I'm really having a lot of fun. You know, let's face it. Being a molecular biologist, a cell biologist, I went back to Georgia Tech and got degrees in artificial intelligence and neural networks. And then I figured out that, you know, when I was getting close to retirement from the corporate world, I wanted to do something fun.
Mm.
And I've always been a space geek, I guess you would say. So I decided I'd go back and get my credentials so I could teach at a university level.
But why astronomy? I mean, I know what it does for me, but what does it do for you?
Well, when I was a kid, Dad and I would lay out in the backyard at summer and just look up. Dad had an interest in stars and the planets and stuff like that. He was that was his thing. And I know one night, Dad and I were looking at the moon, and he says, "Johnny, one day man's going to walk on that." And sure enough, 10 years later, the Apollo program landed man on the moon. And I think at the on my 10th birthday, Mom and Dad bought me my first telescope. And I worked that thing to death. to the point where, you know, I had a paper route when I was a kid. And I got some cash together, and I started making my own telescope. I went to an orchard and started picking strawberries and peaches and apples as a kid that was not too far away. And that money went to furnish, you know, the rest of the pieces to my telescope. I went out and buried a fence post out in the back of our pasture. I lived on a farm. And I scrounged around the barn and got all of the metal that I could find to make my own equatorial mount. And I welded that together and put my telescope on that. And I still got my old telescope pieces.
So in a way, did that lead to your career track in science, just in general? I mean, astronomy and biology are kind of different, but they're both sciences.
I used to watch everything I could space-related on TV back in the late 50s.
Mm.
And, you know, the TV series Lost in Space. And then when Star Trek came on, much later, it was, you know, let's face it, I was glued to the TV.
So what were the kinds of things that that piqued your interest when you would look up as a kid or a teen?
Well, just being able to look through the telescope and then recognize some of the objects that you're actually looking at. First time I purchased one of my current scopes, and I knew where a certain object was. But when I actually put the telescope on that object and actually looked at it, it was like, wow.
After all these years, too.
After all these years.
Now, this project, Grand Universe, is part of the LINC Observatory Space Science Institute. Can you tell me about that, about LINC?
Well, the LINC Space Science Institute was probably the predecessor to everything.
Okay.
The Space Science Institute was a resurrection of the LINC Observatory as far as being utilized. I'm a member of the Indiana Astronomical Society. It's an amateur astronomy. And we used the LINC as our summer and late fall meeting place. We have an agreement with IU, who currently owns the LINC Observatory.
And the LINC is where?
Between Mooresville and Martinsville on Indiana 67.
Mm.
And it's about 5 miles south of Gray Brothers Restaurant on 67 on Observatory Road.
Easy to remember.
Easy to remember.
And so they were the predecessor to everything.
Yes, because basically we had what we called the Phoenix Project. Greg McCauley, who is our CEO, and I got together and we figured out, you know, what we wanted to do with the link, because the link was not being utilized as heavily as what it could be used. It wasn't really a place where people can come and view the night sky. It was only used maybe once or twice a month. And right now, every weekend, there's something going on there. Mostly it is private observation by the Indiana Astronomical Society, but on the first Saturday of each month, we have an open public viewing, providing Mother Nature allows.
Of course.
And she's been rather fickle this year.
It's a hard thing to plan around, huh?
Oh, it is.
Now, we're talking about Grand Universe in Westfield, and in the intro, I said that you were co-leader of the project. So what's your role right now? It's not going to open until we go back to the moon in 2024. So what are you doing right now?
Well, right now, science engagement. So I basically visit NASA, JPL, with my own research, and then also I managed to get two internships for my students with NASA. Kind of wish that I was at their age right now with those two internships.
Exciting things.
Oh, gosh, yes, because NASA will pay for their housing and their per diem, as well as give them a stipend.
Oh, my gosh.
And it's for 6 weeks.
It's a good deal.
Yeah, I wish I could snag that deal myself.
And Westfield is a great place for this right now. I mean, there aren't as many residents there as there are just east in Noblesville and Carmel. So the light pollution's a little lower. But this is an up-and-coming community. 4 years from now, it could be different. Is that a concern for you?
Well, we are looking at not only just observatory or observing the night sky, but we're going to have a robotics there as well. We'll have a moonscape and a Marscape that students can build robotic rovers and then put them on the scapes. And then just like with Mars, there's a 7-minute delay between the time the signal leaves Earth to where it gets to Mars. Well, we'll build in that 7-minute delay and have them maneuver their rover around the Marscape. You know, teaches them not only engineering but science and also some of the other principles that are involved in space exploration.
Namely, patience.
Yeah.
So I guess what is the ultimate goal of Grand Universe in Westfield? What would you like to see it accomplish? Or who would you like to see it affect?
Well, to bring in the next generation of science leaders, really. There are several corporations around Indianapolis that are involved with NASA or the space program. We're hoping that we can foster the high-tech efforts in generating the next generation of leaders.
John Shepherd is Director of Science Engagement with the LINC Observatory Space Science Institute. He's also co-leader of Westfield's Grand Universe Project. John, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. Subscribe so you never miss a topic you care about. On Monday, we will talk about a documentary on child slavery in Ghana that was featured at the Heartland International Film Festival last year, which prompted an Indiana nonprofit to get involved. In the meantime, follow us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana for discussion and topic alerts.
I'm Matt Pelzer. Have a great weekend. Keep your distance. Wash your hands. I'll do the same. This is All In.